Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to On the Ball with Rick Bucher. Here's your host.
Let's send it over to Rick Bucher.
Rick Bucher.
This is On the Ball on the United We Cast Network, and I am Rick Bucher. You can see me on FS1, hear me on Fox Sports Radio, and you can read me on the Fox Sports app and at foxsports.com. You can also follow me on X, the former Twitter, Instagram, and Threads at Rick Bucher. I'm a lot of places, but there's only one place you can hear me talking about story angles and perspectives that you are not likely to find anywhere else, primarily but not exclusively involving the NBA, and that is here. Sometimes epilogue is prologue in sports, meaning what we see and hear after a game often explains what happened during the game. And I don't mean a coach or player describing some part of the action or explaining what they were thinking or what the instructions were or anything like that. I mean in hearing players or coaches talk after a game, they often reveal a mindset. Sometimes it's not even what they say. It's their facial expression and their body language, which at times can actually contradict what they're saying. We're seeing this play out, by the way, everywhere in these playoffs. There's the Oklahoma City Thunder players joining Shea Gilgeous-Alexander en masse when he's conducting post-game interviews, all of them looking over his shoulder, listening intently to his answers and nodding as if he's dropping pearls of wisdom, but sort of smirking at the same time. The message is, he's our leader, but he's one of us too. We're just a young bunch. We respect him, but we're going to have fun. Now, NBA players are fairly good at faking chemistry in front of the cameras, but this among the Thunder is clearly genuine and understandable. They're all about the same age. They've all come up together. They've all gone through the trials and tribulations of being in Oklahoma City. They're in Oklahoma City, which is not going to provide a lot of variety in terms of entertainment. That's not a knock on Oklahoma City. It's just the reality. They like being led by Shea, and they like playing together. You can see the same with the New York Knicks, particularly among the Villanova alums, Jalen Brunson, Dante DiVincenzo, and Josh Hart, but pretty much all of them seem to get along really well, at least from what we've seen. And having seen up close that chemistry blossom with the Spurs and Warriors, I understand the power of it, as well as the rarity of it in professional sports. And I also believe it is more essential in today's sports world than maybe in the past. The Boston Celtics didn't hang out together. Larry Bird didn't really like Kevin McHale. Michael Jordan had a select few Chicago Bulls teammates that he was close with and considered confidants. Hakeem Olajuwon was very much a lone wolf with the Houston Rockets. Got along with everybody, but kind of stayed to himself outside of the court. The love-hate relationship between Shaquille O'Neal and Kobe Bryant has been well documented. All the players I mentioned have won multiple championships, but they and their teams won with a mutual, sometimes begrudging respect for each other. Not a whole lot more than that. And it wasn't because they had team dinners and players-only summer workouts and started businesses together or did commercials together. It was because they had a goal. and they were mature enough to understand that they needed each other to achieve it. But back to all that we can learn from watching and listening to players and coaches. And when I say listening, it's not what they say as much as how they say it. It's not just listening to their words or answers, but their tone of voice. That's the danger that I've run into a few times on TV and radio when I'm presented with a quote by the host or someone else to discuss or debate or to break down. If I don't hear the original audio, I don't really know what was said because I don't know how it was said. And as a result, I may respond in a way or have an opinion I wouldn't if I heard the original comment. Which brings me to the two wild finishes in Game 2s this past week that included a couple of controversial non-calls. And before we get into the details, let me just say that with what hair trigger whistles have done to the game, I am ecstatic that we're talking about non-calls, especially at the end of the game. I'm not here to debate whether or not a call should or shouldn't be made. Officials make mistakes. Players make mistakes. Coaches make mistakes. TV analysts, podcast hosts, and writers make mistakes. The difference is, officials, we have instant replay after instant replay, and there's an expectation, maybe because they're the law of the land, whatever, we expect them to be perfect. Reality is, they're not going to be any more perfect than any of us doing our jobs. What I don't like, and I'm particularly saddened by, is hearing great players talking as if the refs are being purposely unfair to them or their team. And I'm not talking about good players. I'm talking about some of the best in the game right now. As if there is an agenda. As if the refs have something against them. Which, for the most part, it's the exact opposite. Star players do get the benefit of the doubt. I've had referees tell me that. They're not trying to tilt it in their direction, but they get the benefit of the doubt more often than not. I would say probably the greatest litmus for where the league, people in the league, not fans, people in the league see LeBron James is that he does not get the same whistle that he has in the past. He still gets a generous whistle, but it's not the one that he has had in the past. And it's because he's not a great player anymore, stats aside. And again, it's particularly wild when you consider the players who are doing the complaining right now, Joel Embiid and LeBron James. And LeBron, in part, complaining, in part for himself, thought there was an and one, should have been an and one at the end of Game 2, if I'm not mistaken, and thought that D'Angelo Russell didn't get a call he should have gotten. But no team benefits from the whistle more than the Los Angeles Lakers, and no player benefits from it more than Joel Embiid. The Lakers were second in the league in free throw attempts this season, while their opponents were 29th. I think for the last 2 or 3 years, there's been no greater disparity between the number of free throws shot by a team and the number of free throws shot by its opponent. LeBron himself is 16th among players, which I would say is probably, and I know this is going to, some LeBron fans are going to take issue with this, I think that's probably higher than he ranks in the league in terms of players and their ability. The 76ers, meanwhile, were 4th in free throw attempts and their opponents 6th. So it's not as if they collectively have had whistles work against them in any way. They've slightly favored them, the whistles have. In large part because of Embiid, because he averaged 11.6 free throws a game, which is a full free throw more per game than any other player in the league. He led in free throw attempts per game this season, far and away. And he thinks he's not getting a fair whistle. There's a reason that Isaiah Hartenstein from the Knicks said going into the series that the Knicks knew Embiid is going to hunt for fouls and that they have to play him a certain way to avoid the referees from calling them. He's sort of become the big man version of James Harden. Now you go in knowing that the referees are going to give him calls when he does certain things, and you have to change how you defend him because of that. That's a benefit to Joel Embiid. The issues at the end of the Knicks 76ers game, game two, didn't have to do with Embiid not getting a call per se. My point is that the whistle has generally benefited the Sixers and Embiid, so for him or anybody in Philadelphia to suggest that they lost game two because of the officials is particularly galling, especially if you look at how that game ended. And for those who need their memories refreshed, the Sixers led 100-96 with 47 seconds left and Kyle Lowry going to the line to shoot two free throws. Lowry made the first and missed the second. In my mind, error won by the Sixers. The Knicks went to the other end, nearly lost the ball in the middle of the floor, got it back, and found Jalen Brunson in the corner. A sidestep, escape dribble, and with about 4 seconds left on the shot clock, Brunson launched his sixth three-pointer of the game. The first five had missed. And this one looked to be off as well, the ball hitting the rim from about a 35-degree angle on the wing. But as fortune would have it, ball bounced straight up and in. And that made it 101 Sixers, 99 Knicks, with 27 seconds left. Philly's possession. Second Philly mistake. They did not call a timeout. Instead, Lowry tried to quickly inbound it to Tyrese Maxey, who pushed off his defender, Josh Hart, and then spun away from Jalen Brunson, who had left Lowry to double Maxey. Now, Lowry gave him a sort of hot potato, underhanded pass from about 3 feet away to Maxey's far left hand. That's a tough kind of pass to corral for someone moving as fast as Maxey was to get free, even if it's on the money. And this one wasn't. And as a result, he couldn't handle it. Mistake three. The ball bounced off his left hand and straight up in the air. And I'm going to put this less on Maxey and more on Lowry. It was a bad inbound. Nick Nurse, the head coach, later said that he leaves it up to Lowry to make a decision. If somebody's open, immediately inbound it. If not, they call timeout. Lowry went ahead and passed it, even though Maxey really wasn't open and did not call a timeout. So now Maxey is sandwiched between Brunson and Hart as he's running down or chasing the ball. Brunson has somehow gotten in front of him and Hart is behind him for what is essentially a jump ball. And Maxey comes down with it, but he loses his balance and potentially from getting bumped by Hart. I've yet to see a camera angle that showed me that clearly. Hart, in any event, pulls back his arms to avoid getting a foul call. And when no whistle blows, he then reaches down and rips the ball out of Maxey's hands and whips it to Dante DiVincenzo for a three-pointer. Dante misses, but Hartenstein has a clear line to the rim. Again, you want to put this on mistake four by the Philadelphia 76ers. Nobody boxes out Hartenstein. Nobody gets a body on him. He runs from the top of the key to the front of the rim untouched, past four Sixers. Mistake five. No Sixer actually went to go get the ball. And Hartenstein grabs the rebound. Now he falls to the floor, but before a Sixer can tie him up, he shovels the ball out to OG Anunoby, who swings it to DiVincenzo for another try, and he buries this one. So now, it's Knicks 102, Sixers 101, with 13.1 seconds left, and the Sixers' possession, and this time they call timeout. Philadelphia moves the inbound to the front court, but Nick Batum, after checking the front court action, whips the ball in the back court for Maxey, who is guarded by Anunoby. And Maxey gets a head of steam right away. Embiid sets a back screen on Anunoby right around the Knicks logo, practically half court. And Maxey then threads his way into the paint. Hartenstein is chasing him from behind. Maxey, trying to keep Hartenstein from blocking his layup, is practically even with the backboard when he releases the ball. He gets in too deep. And as a result, the shot comes off the glass too hard and rolls off the rim. And the Knicks recover, game over. I believe they fouled and final score was 104-101, but essentially game over there. And make it mistake five in terms of how Maxey attacked the rim. But in any case, five instances where Philadelphia could have done something different and it would have changed the outcome of the game. And if you watch Coach Nick Nurse through the entire sequence, or that last minute or 27 seconds, last minute, let's say, he has his hands raised over his head as if ready to call a timeout when Lowry initially takes the ball out of bounds, but then quickly pulls them down when Lowry passes it. Again, Nurse said later, it's because he generally relies on Lowry to make that decision. So then he looked to call a timeout again after Maxey went to the floor. But it's hard to tell if Maxey still has the ball when Nurse signals for it. And I can understand why the trail ref, who is closest to Nurse, they're not that far away. And so Nurse saying that the ref looked right at me, I don't know. I'll take his word for it. The ref was looking in the direction of Maxey and the ball as well, which is where his attention should be. And because he had the clearest view of the ball. And so if he didn't give Nurse a timeout, if he sees Nurse in his peripheral and sees the timeout signal, but he didn't give the timeout, it may be because he's seeing the ball and he's not seeing it in Maxey's hands at the time that Nurse is calling timeout. Because the timing of when Hart swipes the ball and when Nurse signals for the timeout is not at all clear. And just as an aside, I have no idea what prompted Stephen A. Smith to say he saw from his courtside seat that Maxey got mugged three or four times, other than to flaunt the fact that he was sitting in a courtside seat, and maybe to dial up the hyperbole to get everyone's attention. Mugged is a pretty extreme term. There's no evidence at any point that Maxey got mugged once, much less three or four times. Mugged is like, to me, bear hugged or smacked. Something. Look, Maxey gave as good as he got on the initial inbounds play when he pushed off on Hart. And he didn't have control of the ball initially after the inbound pass. And I didn't see contact sending him to the floor any more than it did Hartenstein on Dante's initial miss. I know the league's last two-minute report says that three calls were missed in that sequence on the Knicks, but I'd love to know on what basis, because I didn't see egregious contact. I saw players colliding, fighting for the ball with equal access to it. They let the players decide, and the players decided, and that, to me, is the way it should be. Now, Embiid came out after the game and declared that the Sixers were the better team and that they were still going to win the series. As if there was a question that they still could, or as if his team needed to hear him say it. If that's the case, the Sixers are a lot more fragile than I thought. They'd lost two games on the road, and now they were going home. That's sort of standard operating procedure in a close series. Especially for the seventh seed playing the second seed. I from the beginning, I expected this series to go six or seven games. It was a testament to the Philadelphia 76ers and Joel Embiid. I'm really not feeling any player saying we're the better team after going down 2-0 and having lost three times to that same team during the regular season. Show a little respect. The Knicks earned it. Go ahead and say, I know we can play better, and we will. We made mistakes down the stretch and got out-hustled, but those are things we can fix. Because all of that is accurate and true. The we're the better team and we're still going to win the series is really nothing more than bulletin board material for the Knicks. For what? Again, you're the seventh seed, playing the first two games on the road in a best of seven. You're now going home. What was the need to say, oh, hey, don't worry, we're still going to win the series, or we're the better team. No, you're not. Didn't prove it during the regular season. Haven't proved it in the series to this point. What are we talking about? The Lakers, meanwhile, are a study in how the attitude of one player can spread like wildfire through a locker room. Now, I can't fault Anthony Davis for ending his post-game press conference abruptly after being asked a strange question about the game-winning play, Jamal Murray's buzzer beater over him for that gut-wrenching Game 2 loss. The reporter, for those who may not have heard it, asked if AD had been screened or something. What? Clearly, he wasn't screened. There was no screen. And there's a good chance that AD drops the mic after whatever question was asked about that play. He was clearly still heated and frustrated. Understandably, if you're a pro athlete, you learn how to put that away before you go to the podium. Be able to calm yourself. You know the questions are going to be asked. You know you're going to be asked about that play. So that you're not emotionally ready for it. He's been around a long time. Young player. Okay, I'll give you that mulligan once or twice starting out. But at some point you realize you're going to be asked about the plays of the game. And maybe ask a different question. Because there's a good chance AD drops the mic after whatever question was asked, but at least make it one that indicates you understand the situation. Maybe ask if he thinks there was anything else he could have done on that play. Or ask what the Lakers could have done not to let the game get down to that play, a final possession with Denver having the ball and a chance to win. Because that's the heart of it. The game shouldn't have come down to that for the Lakers. Not with a 6-point lead that they held with 3 minutes left. Not with the ball and the score tied with 30 seconds left. Not after having led the game for 45 of the game's 48 minutes. Now, what kills me about all that I've got to say about AD in this episode is that I've stumped for AD this year like never before. This was the best season of his career in my mind. Being a consistent force at both ends, playing through nicks and dings to log the most games he's ever played in one season, 76. That's practically an Iron Man in today's game. But then he says, after this loss, we have stretches where we don't know what we're doing on both ends of the floor. The Lakers might as well have conceded the series right there. Now, the media was quick to tag it as a vote of no confidence in head coach Darvin Ham, taking all responsibility away from Anthony Davis for saying what he said. And maybe it was a vote of no confidence. But it's also a vote of no confidence in the entire team. It's an indictment of the entire team. A no coming back from indictment. You're not beating the defending champions, a team that you simply don't match up with to begin with, by announcing to the world that your team doesn't know what it's doing at times. The best player on the team saying that offers an out to everyone and anyone looking for one. And when you've lost 10 times, now 11 times, to the same team, trust me, guys are looking for reasons to bail, to let go of the rope, to say, nah, this is too much for me. It bothers me that not one single media person to this point, other than me right now, has called out Anthony Davis for saying what he said. Because it's something you take up with your teammates in the locker room where there is no out, where you acknowledge what has gone on and you figure out how you're going to fix it before game three, before the series is over. But this is the same AD who recently also complained about never winning a Defensive Player of the Year award, saying, I'll never get it. The league doesn't like me. I'm the best defensive player in the league. I can switch 1 through 5. I can guard the pick and roll the best in the league from a big standpoint. I block shots. I rebound. And I would say, yes, you can. You can do all those things. When you're healthy and available and in shape, which has been a very limited time in AD's career. Now, I posted that I had him third on my Defensive Player of the Year ballot this year, and that I wanted to put him first. In fact, I even told some people I was planning to put him first on my ballot. This was a while ago. But after looking at everything, watching a lot of tape, I couldn't justify it because, one, of where the Lakers are in terms of a team. They're a mediocre defensive team. They wouldn't even be that without him. But it's also because if you do watch the tape, he doesn't play with the same consistent energy defensively that Rudy Gobert and Bam Adebayo do. And I said that was my reason for putting him third rather than first, is because it's rare when he gives multiple efforts. Rare, maybe I misspoke there. He doesn't give multiple efforts as often as Gobert and Bam. That would have been the best way to say it. But you should have heard the excuses from Lakers Nation when they read that. This is the funniest one for me. You must not watch games. No, I watch games. Try again. I'm watching games. So this is a little bit like in the last episode when I was like, if you don't know why someone said something, if you don't know why Steve Kerr made a decision, then that's on you, because there's logic behind what he's done. You can't just say, oh, he doesn't know what he's doing. Or in my case, oh, he's just not watching the games. No, I'm watching the games. So maybe there's something that you need to understand in order to understand where I'm coming from, if it matters to you. Now, someone posted a clip of him blocking two shots on the same defensive sequence, as if that proved that that's what AD always does. Or the other excuse was, yeah, because AD has to average 30 at the other end, unlike the other two. For the record, AD's never averaged 30 points in his career. And yes, he has to be an offensive threat for these Lakers and has been good offensively through the course of his career, but not consistently. Again, that's the whole deal. It's not consistent. He shows you flashes of what he's capable of. And I can only suppose that Lakers fans either are confusing how he attacks the offensive glass with multiple efforts, because that does happen on a consistent basis, or they have burned into their memory the times that he does make multiple efforts on defense. That they're just, either they're not, they don't recognize what all the time actually means. Because he has made multiple efforts on defense. I didn't say, even in my maybe not best worded initial post, I never said he never did. What is perhaps most galling, though, is that right after complaining about the fact that I would have AD third on my Defensive Player of the Year ballot, I'm watching, and AD complaining that he hasn't won a DPOY, I'm watching AD half-heartedly closing out on rotations against the Nuggets. After just having watched the Heat game, where Bam has led Miami to an upset of Boston on its home floor by making multiple efforts on both ends of the floor, being a force offensively and defensively. And I know we're talking playoffs and it's a regular season award, but still, I'm just talking about, this is AD complaining what he hasn't been recognized as. And I'm watching the three players in question play, and AD is the false hustle closeout, late and really not contesting. Bam, on the other hand, playing like a madman. And then Gobert doing the same against Yusuf Nurkic and the Suns, getting out and defending on the perimeter, contesting Booker threes. Like, the disparity, if you put those videos side by side by side, you'd understand exactly what I'm talking about. And we're in an age where someone thinks finding a single clip of a player doing something is proof that they do it all the time. I've said it before, but I'll say it again. The problem for those who question my perspective is that I do watch the games, and I often rewatch them slowly, multiple times, focusing on a different player or space on the floor in a given sequence. I'm kind of nutty about it that way. I really want to be able to see what happened, because I want to judge fairly. At the end of the day, it's takes a lot of effort, takes a lot of talent, takes a lot of commitment to be what all of these players are. And to judge between one and the other and get it right, I think is what I owe them because of that. I owe it to the players who are doing it the right way. And maybe I owe it to the players that are not, so that they're motivated to do it the right way. It's how AD framed it, his complaint, that explains why, in spite of all his extraordinary talent, he is generally viewed as a number two, and he has one ring from one unusual season to show for it. The league doesn't like you? What, you mean the media? The media that was crowning you a top three player in the league when you were in New Orleans with one playoff series win to your credit? The media that said you deserve to be MVP of the bubble championship, not LeBron? Now, I wasn't part of the media in either of those cases, but I did take note of the Clutch Agency touting LeBron for MVP this year when, in my estimation, he wasn't even the MVP of his team. AD was. But here's the thing. If you can blame falling short on the whims of others, you don't have to take accountability for whatever it is you haven't achieved. And that mindset is clearly contagious. Because next we heard Rui Hachimura saying that the Lakers just don't have enough experience together to beat the Nuggets. And he said this with games still to be played in the series. Now, we've seen the same from LeBron James. LeBron James lost the ball out of bounds in the last game after a screen up top by Taurean Prince that didn't really work. And LeBron loses the ball out of bounds, and then he turns around and he starts yelling at Taurean Prince, I assume because of how the screen was set. As if the screen somehow led to LeBron losing the ball out of bounds. He just lost the ball out of bounds. But this lack of accountability, this lack of my bad, when it really is your bad, is contagious, particularly in a situation like this when it's so tough, when it's an uphill climb. It's easy. It's easier to take the easy way out.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
It's not how winning players think or talk, though. And I know that LeBron has had a lot of success, which is kind of baffling in that there are times, though, where he clearly makes a business decision. It says, this is not worth my time. I believe it's one of the reasons why he's had the longevity that he has. It's been very calculated. I actually can't blame him for that. In a way, I admire it. It's the ultimate business move. But when it comes to competitors, when it comes to the guys who do the remarkable things of overcoming situations that you didn't think were possible in overcoming, I immediately think of Warriors in 21-22 and Steph Curry and how he led them through that year after 2 years of being abysmal, then there's a great distinction. You lose out on some of those opportunities. LeBron, to my in my estimation, has had one of those when they came back when the Cavs came back on the 73-9 Warriors in the final. But as much as LeBron fans don't want to believe this, if you talk to people on the Cleveland Cavaliers team, he was not really the leader of that team. He wasn't the leader of the Cavs the first time around. It was a lot of the ancillary supporting cast that held the line, that held the belief, that instilled the confidence. LeBron is good at saying all the right things in front of the camera, or when he knows the camera's in on the huddle and what he's going to say pregame. He's very conscious of that, and he's very conscious of creating a certain image. But if you know people inside the game, they will tell you a different story, and you will just have to take my word for it. But it's why I have the perspective that I have. And in the case of AD, so the league doesn't like him. Is the reason AD hasn't had more success because the league doesn't like him too? Is that why he hasn't been able to stay healthy? Because the league doesn't like him? It just seems such an odd, flimsy, unspecified excuse. And look, there is so much good and admirable going on right now that I hate to harp on things that are disappointing. But I'm doing it because, as I said at the start, these are tells about what we can expect to happen. I'll give you a few other examples before I go. Boston Celtics coach Joe Mazzulla saying after the Miami Heat upset his team on their home floor in Game 2 by making 23 of 43 threes. That's a 53.5% shooting mark. Mazzulla said that the Heat's long-range shots were moderately to heavily contested. Now, no team shoots over 50% from long range if their shots are contested. The Warriors in their heyday didn't do that. The Heat, who shot 37% from long range during the season and are missing their best three-point shooter in Jimmy Butler, don't do that. Watching the game, I would say that the Celtics did not defend the three in Game 2 any worse than they did in Game 1, but that's different. I really thought that the Heat simply missed open shots in Game 1, that their execution in creating open shots was good, and that it was a talent differential. Celtics just had more talent. They were knocking down more shots. Heat simply are not, especially with they're missing their primary drivers in Jimmy Butler and Terry Rozier. When it comes to three-pointers, having drivers, having guys who can get into the paint and then kick out creates a different kind of shot. One, it generally creates more time and space because the defense naturally sucks in. But it also has the ball coming out into a shooter's pocket more often than when the ball is swung on the perimeter, side to side, because that generally requires a shooter to reach for the ball, pivot, square up, gather, and then fire away. And even if you have the time, even if you do it quickly, it's a matter of trying to get yourself set and lined up with the basket, as opposed to being lined up, ready to shoot, ball comes out straight at you, all you got to do is rise up and shoot it. When we're talking about team percentages and efficiency, those kinds of things can have a noticeable effect. I sense a bit of contrarian in Mazzulla when it comes to answering media questions. It's a way of his of suggesting the question is wrong-headed or lacks validity, which then undermines the reporter's credibility. I don't really think Mazzulla likes the media, by and large. And it's an understated, what are you talking about tone. And this is by no means the first time I've heard him use this tactic. In any case, I don't believe, one, that the question merited that, and two, that Mazzulla has earned the right to be an ass. And the bottom line is, the Celtics' perimeter defense was in no way good enough, however he wants to describe it. And I would hope that my coach would be setting a level or an expectation of how we are going to play. And this wasn't good enough. Instead of, yeah, it was pretty good. Again, not the mindset of a coach, a championship coach. Next up, the Timberwolves. I picked them to beat the Suns in their first round series, which they now lead 3-0. Thank you very much. But man, there are signs that some of Minnesota's best players are just not mentally where they need to be to knock off the Denver Nuggets. It's one thing to knock off the Phoenix Suns, who are a mess in their own right. Nuggets are a completely different category. And I think as a result of the regular season, a lot of people put the Timberwolves, more so even than the Oklahoma City Thunder, in the same category as the Nuggets. And I'm here to tell you, they don't belong in the same category. And case in point, Karl Anthony Towns hits a wide open three in game three against the Suns. It's the third quarter, early in the third quarter, 8:07 left in the period. And Towns' three puts the Timberwolves up 69-58. The game is a long way from over. This is game three, lest I say it again, of the first round. But Towns stands there admiring what he just did, gazing at the rim, mouth agape in feigned awe, as if it was an incredible work of art that he had just created. A masterpiece. Who could possibly hit a shot like this? And I know this is going to sound like I'm nitpicking, but that is a dude who does not see the big picture, who is so taken by himself in that inconsequential moment. Mike Conley had just hit a similar three the possession before and ran back on D as if it was no big deal. Because if you're playing for a championship, not just playing to win game three, not just playing to win the first round, if you're playing to win it all, then that shot is no big deal. It should feel like no big deal. You should treat it as no big deal. Especially in this, it was a warm-up three. I mean, it was created by his teammates busting their asses down the floor and swinging it back to him in the trail position. And I know some of you may well say, hey, doesn't Steph Curry celebrate shots that he makes in the middle of the game? Yes, he does. But go back and look. Not when no one is within 20 feet of him. He'll do it after he split a double team and arced it over a closing seven-footer, or when it's a three that gives the Warriors the lead after trailing all game, or wins a game. It's something momentous, difficult, or meaningful in terms of where they're trying to go, which is to win a championship. He knows that this is one of the plays that needs to be made to win a championship. I cannot in any way describe Karl Anthony Towns 3 in that moment as one of those. It was just another three against a Phoenix Suns team that is awful in transition and closing out on three-point shooters. Now, I might have shared with you that I heard from a scout that another Minnesota Timberwolves player, Anthony Edwards, sometimes tries shots in a game just to see if he can pull them off. Banking in a three, shooting from behind the backboard. And I'm not talking about situations that demand it. I'm talking about just coming down and trying it because he thinks he can. That is not a serious player. That's a young, incredibly talented player messing around. And championships aren't won messing around at any point in a game. I know. It sounds like an old man yelling at clouds again. I get it. And I like Ant. I like his spirit. It's infectious. His teammates like him because what he's doing doesn't come from a place of selfishness, even though in a way it is. You've heard them, Rudy Gobert, Mike Conley, any number of them. They're complimenting him for his growth. They're complimenting him for watching tape. Now, think about it for a second. These players feel the need to compliment him for working on his game, for evolving, for putting in the extra work. He is arguably the most talented player on that team. Maybe not even arguably. The most talented player on that team. And they feel the need to let everybody know, you know what, he's really working. And what it says is he wasn't always working. And that they know that he has to continue working to get to where he needs to get in order for them to get to where they would like to get. He is, as I said, an incredibly talented player. But what he does at times comes from not understanding the focus necessary to build championship habits. And I have seen this a lot with really talented players. The game comes to them relatively easy. And as a result, they don't understand the focus that it requires. That's what made Michael Jordan so damn special. And that lack of focus comes from a lack of awareness. And I just hope that Ant gets that awareness someday. I'm rooting for it. But I'm not convinced he'll find it in time for the Timberwolves to make good on it this season. Overall, I sometimes get the sense that a lot of guys in the league are just parroting what they've seen great players do before them, as if mimicking the histrionics is a stamp that they're great too, while not recognizing the context is different. I would say Joel Embiid and D'Angelo Russell both proclaiming after going down 2-0 in their respective series, we're still going to win this thing. We've had any number of players that have said that at various times over the course of the NBA history. But in this case, in either of those situations, is that necessary? They were both down 2-0 on the road. So you're telling fans not to give up on you. In doing so, you're actually telling on yourself. Because you're not only acknowledging their doubts, you're validating them. No. I know you probably have reason to doubt us, but don't. And I explained earlier this year that I realized why D'Lo can't replicate his sensational regular season performances in the playoffs. And it's because he said that he plays his best when he's not thinking. And you can get away with that in the regular season. The postseason is all about being intentional in everything you do and understanding why you do everything you do. Doesn't mean you're going to win. Doesn't mean you're going to execute every time. Doesn't mean you're going to get it right. But you have to understand what the goal is, where the bullseye is, why it has to be done a certain way, the time and place for doing it. And it is brutally unforgiving. I mean, I don't know how many of us out here have the mental tenacity to stay stuck in the way you have to win an NBA championship. I don't know if I do. Honestly, I'd like to think that I do. I flatter myself in thinking it. But knowing what it takes, knowing how hard it is, how unforgiving it is, I don't know. Which is why I just supremely admire those who have done it. And those who have done it multiple times, goodness. The mental toughness to win a ring begins with never questioning your ability to do it. And I don't know about you guys, but there's nothing, very few things in my life, very few. This job, writing, I've never doubted my ability to do it and to do it at the highest level. But beyond that, maybe early on in my career, you know, as an athlete early on, high school, whatever, very few things beyond that. And so it's never questioning your ability to do it or giving any credence to anyone else questioning if you can do it. It is an irrational confidence. And Ant's confidence might not even be irrational considering how talented he is, but it is misplaced and directed at the wrong objective. As I said, I'm sure some of my young listeners see all this as an old man yelling at clouds. And my years of experience do have something to do with my perspective. Because there was a time when I questioned just how important all of this stuff was. I knew some of it was. All of it? Really? Is it this exacting? But over the years, watching closely how championship players and teams carry themselves, how almost exhaustingly diligent they are about practicing a certain mindfulness in everything they do, I've come to believe it's an essential part of winning it all. And it's not as if it can't be learned or developed, but learned or developed, it must. All right, that does it for this episode of On the Ball on the United WeCast Network. Please rate and review the show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. We should be wrapped up with the first round by the time another episode comes out. And there are a number of things to look at as a result of that. I will be in LA doing TV all week, but I will be sure to put out an episode here in the next 3 or 4 days at the very least, because it's that time of year and there's a lot to get into, as the length of this podcast would certainly suggest. In the meantime, as always, thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.